MechCast, Friday, July 1st, 2011. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam. This is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. We have a lot of stuff to cover in this episode, so I'm going to not belabor the issue. I'm going to dive right into everything. Before I get started, I want to take a quick moment, thank one of our show's sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. If you haven't checked out Notebook, it is a really great application, I think, for me, because of its versatility. It's can be used for so many different things. Obvious one is taking notes. If you're a student, if you're in class, if you're working and you have to go to a lot of meetings, you need to keep track of stuff, it's great for that. You can use it for organizing lists. You can set up even a checkbox column so you can check off items as you're working on them. It's great for doing research because it has the web clippings feature where you can use Apple's built-in services to clip articles and information into your notebooks and get those organized. You can load in images, layer on sticky notes and flags and stuff like that. Essentially, it tries to replicate a physical real-world notebook. So if you've used a spiral-bound notebook or a three-ring notebook, you know what I'm talking about. And they even mimic those styles because you can get all different kinds of paper types. If you prefer to have graph paper or college-ruled yellow paper, you can change that stuff. They've done a really good job replicating that experience. Another great built-in feature is the ability to embed PDF files, so you can put those right into your notebook. So really assemble things together, gather them up, get them all in one place and neatly organized. It does an awesome job of that. And then they layer on really advanced stuff like great drawing tools, voice notation, and a whole lot more. They have free trials available on their website, so you can try before you buy. And they also have an iPad version available, so you can check it all out, get more information and details over at circusponies.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's get into some of the stories over the past week, couple weeks. I know I've been off on vacation. The schedule's been a little bit crazy. It's summertime. But I want to talk about this story that's been running around about Apple doing an actual Apple-branded television. Not the Apple TV box, the little add-on thing, but Tech Daily has reported that they heard Apple is working with a what they're calling major supplier. A lot of people would assume, and makes sense to me, that it would be Samsung, to actually OEM to create an Apple-branded television LCD TV that they would sell in the Apple store. Now, this rumor's been around for years and years. Victor Cahiao has been talking about it. I think Jason Calacanis brought it up. It's been mentioned by even Walt Mossberg. And I still think it's unlikely that Apple's going to actually do a television set. One of the reasons I have for thinking that is that Apple, I don't think, has any interest in bringing a device that's going to get over the air or through your cable box TV signals. They have iTunes. They have a lot of content there. They're really pushing that. I think what we're seeing with iCloud and deals with streaming services like Netflix, I think that's that direction Apple believes the future of television is. Steve Jobs said in that D All Things Digital, I don't know if you saw that, where Walt Mossberg asked him about this, they really are looking to change television to a certain degree. So I think that's the direction that they're moving in. And what's the advantage of Apple doing a high-end, really expensive LCD display with Apple TV integrated into it? Ask Google how that sort of device is going with them. You have Google TV. It got a little buzz when they announced it, but really it hasn't had a lot of pickup. A $3,000 television set, I think, is something that Apple's not, that's a consumer electronics item that I think Apple's not ready to delve into yet. The Apple TV is a different type of product. It's a small box and it works with any television. Apple doesn't really necessarily need to integrate that. My theory is that one thing Apple may do is actually integrate the Apple TV into Apple's LCD cinema display. And when this TV story came up, I started thinking a lot about this stuff, and this came to my mind mainly because I think it seems like a next logical step. The Apple TV components and circuits, now that it's a streaming-only device, have gotten so small, it could easily be integrated into that display, and it now fits with Apple's PC-free technology. If you look at the technologies that Apple is working on, like AirPlay. So imagine you only had an iPad as your only device. You can now configure and set that up on your home network. If you had an Apple LCD cinema display with Apple TV integrated into it, you could use features like the video mirroring to have that be a larger display. And you couple that with a Bluetooth keyboard, and suddenly you almost have what is a desktop or a notebook computer experience, not using anything like a traditional PC. And I'm saying traditional in air quotes, even though you can't see that on the podcast. But that is something that's interesting, and then adds functionality. You can now stream your iTunes to that. You can, from your iPad or your iPhone, you can have that television-like experience without having a television, without having a tuner, without hooking it into a cable network, but getting all of your content through Apple and through the apps that you might have installed on your device. So if Apple can open up the APIs and allow people like Netflix and ABC and all these people that are putting out entertainment apps for the iPad to leverage that, and it sounds like that's what they want to do, then that becomes really interesting, and I think something that Apple might take advantage of. But even that, I think, is a little bit extreme. I'm not expecting Apple to integrate the Apple TV technology into an LCD display quite yet. I don't know if it would happen this year. I don't know if it happened next year, but it's an interesting thought to think about. And that's what came to my mind when I started hearing these rumors about Apple doing an actual branded TV. But I don't think they are going to put that out there. I think it's something Apple's always thinking about the next things and what they're going to do, and they're playing around. There might be some prototypes out there that they're playing with, but they seem to me to be moving in a different direction. A lot of rumors over the past couple weeks about new models of Macs that are in the works. Mac Rumors is reporting that there's a new MacBook Air coming out. They even reported this week that there might be a design change with a new model coming out with a black anodized aluminum finish. They put some images up on their website. They are saying that it will be available just on a top-end model of the MacBook Air. A lot of people are thinking that Apple's going to do a new MacBook Air pretty soon. All of the rumors seem to be pointing to at least a refresh, with Apple adding Thunderbolt technology and the Sandy Bridge architecture. 9to5 Mac was reporting that there wouldn't be a black model, but Apple might drop the pricing slightly, with prices on the new MacBook Air starting at $899. They also say the models would feature the Intel 1.8 gigahertz Core i7s, the 1.7 gigahertz Core i7s, and the 1.7 gigahertz Core i5 processors. So that bump up to that Sandy Bridge architecture. And 9to5 Mac seems to think those would be arriving in the next couple weeks, around July 19th. There's also been reports that the Mac Pros and the Mac Minis might be getting an update. I think I read some things online saying that third-party suppliers, these are non-Apple retailers, are running low on stock and don't show new inventories coming in anytime soon. Apple's website, interestingly, on all of these products still has pretty short ship times. So when we start seeing third-party retailers reporting shortages or getting low quantities and not being able to get a hold of new ones, that's the earliest signs that there might be some revs coming. When Apple starts dropping their lead times on products, that's when things get a little more interesting. It seems we're getting closer, although some of the reports seem to be thinking that we'll see some new models early to mid-July, so you'd think you'd already be seeing Apple's numbers drop off, but who knows. As far as where the MacBook Pros are going, again, all these updates are pointing to Apple adding Sandy Bridge and Thunderbolt technology. I think Apple wants to roll out Thunderbolt ports across the line pretty quickly, so I do think there's some validity to these rumors. The Mac Pros might get up to 16 cores. So there's rumors that there would be 8-core, 12-core, and 16-core models. A lot of processing power on that Pro level. And because of the radical design changes in the processor, there's been some reports that it might not be the Sandy Bridge technology in the Mac Pros, but a whole new CPU custom made by Apple and Intel, sort of a joint venture. And they have done that in the past. The original processor, I believe, that came out in the MacBook Air was something that Apple worked with Intel to design. And they have all that in-house chip design talent who've been working on the A4 stuff. So they certainly could do something like that. That would be interesting to see. Apple Insider has also noted that MacBook supplies have become severely constrained at some of the third-party resellers. Again, Apple's still listing a 24-hour ship time, but we could see a refresh of the MacBook Pro, and it's long overdue for a refresh. It was last updated in May 2010. So just to summarize, new MacBook Airs being rumored, new Mac Pros being rumored, new Mac Minis being rumored, basically anything that hasn't received a Thunderbolt update. And the time frame, a lot of people are looking for Apple to do it on or around the release of Lion, whenever that becomes a publicly available. Apple so far has said just in July, but more on that in a minute. There's also looming iPhone rumors, iPhone 5 rumors, iPhone 4S. Nobody really seems to know whether or not Apple's going to do iPhone 5 branding or iPhone 4S branding. It depends on who you ask. But as far as what's going to be potentially in a new iPhone design, there's been some debate on whether or not Apple upped the camera, the rear-facing camera, to 5 or 8 megapixels. There's also been these rumors about a moved flash, although in the past week or so, that's recently been changed or updated, with some sites thinking that we'll see a dual flash, which I guess is better for the color balance and lighting if you're using an LED flash, to actually have two that are kind of separated, one on either side of the back. The one other camera-related thing we heard is that Apple has a patent to potentially use the tilt sensors in the phone, capture that data, and use that to correct distortions in photos that you might be taking. It's hard with the patent stuff. I don't cover it a whole lot, but this one sounded interesting to me and seemed like a logical step in upgrading the camera technology in the phones to make better pictures. Although Apple has a lot of patents out there, and a lot of times patent technology doesn't even make it into the products. Some rumors saying that there's going to be radical design changes with a new iPhone 5. Again, or not, depending on who you ask. So the thing I'm finding funny about all these rumors, I don't know if you do too, is that they seem to be all over the board, and everybody's really just guessing. We don't really know what Apple's gonna have in the pipeline, and depending on where the rumors are coming from, you're hearing different stories. And I think part of that is that Apple is always working on different things. They're trying out different things. So I think different people are seeing different prototypes, different design options, and then when these come together in the media, it suddenly seems sporadic, like, you know, everybody's just guessing at stuff. But there's probably a little bit of truth in all of these, and a lot of speculation in a lot of them. But I can't really see a radical design change. I mean, just based on the thinness of the device, you only have so much room in the current designs to play around with. So things like changing materials on the back, we've seen some designs that show Apple's going to a new metal back design, maybe a tapered front edge, more like the MacBook Air. I might argue that I don't think those are really radical design changes. I think they're kind of revolutionary. And a lot of this design stuff has to do with whether you're talking about an iPhone 5 or an iPhone 4S. If it's a 4S, it's kind of this evolutionary update, where an iPhone 5, from what I've been reading, would be a more extreme design change. As far as the internals, they're saying maybe a dual core processor, maybe a larger edge-to-edge screen, higher resolution is not really being thrown out there. It seems like it'd still have the same Retina display resolution that we have in the current generation. But I think there's a lot of playing around here and a lot of fudge factor, and we're going to have to wait and see what Apple comes up with. This rumors still all do seem to point to some sort of release of a new iPhone in September. So if you've been considering a purchase, you might want to hold off for a little bit. And some of the sales numbers we've been seeing have kind of reflected the fact that people seem to be waiting to find out what Apple does in September around the release of iOS 5. The release of macOS 10 Lion is looming. It's July. Apple said it would be out this month. We don't know exactly when, but it's starting to feel like it could happen any day now, maybe in the next week or two. Still a lot of questions surrounding Lion. Apple gave us some details at WWDC, but additional details have kind of been leaking out slowly. There hasn't been a lot of buzz. I think everybody's just waiting to get it on their desktops. One of the huge questions a lot of people have is, will you need Snow Leopard to be able to upgrade to Lion? Apple's distributing it exclusively through the Mac App Store, so you're going to have that. And a customer reportedly emailed Steve Jobs directly and asked, do I need Snow Leopard to be able to upgrade to Lion? He responded with a one-word response, simply yes. Now, this was a rumored email, so we have to take it with a grain of salt, but it's looking like, and everything that I'm reading seems to point to the fact that you're going to have Snow Leopard installed first to be able to upgrade to Lion. That could have huge implications for some of you. Maybe you haven't upgraded to Snow Leopard yet, and there's no word on whether or not Apple will continue to sell Snow Leopard through its retail stores or through its online stores. I had at least one listener email me to say that he checked with his local Apple retail store and they were completely out of boxed copies of Snow Leopard and couldn't tell him when they'd be getting new copies in. I checked on Apple's online store. It is still available there for 24-hour shipment. But historically, Apple, when they release a new operating system, stops selling the old one. So they might have to do something different in this case, especially if you're going to be required to have Snow Leopard installed. There's a lot of people out there. Well, I guess maybe not a lot. One of the numbers I read was that 95% of Mac users have already upgraded, who can upgrade to Snow Leopard, have already upgraded. So the 5% of those of you out there still running Leopard who think that you might want to upgrade to Lion, you might want to pick up your copy of Snow Leopard now. I'd love to know. This was the report I got was just from one listener at one Apple retail store. I haven't been able to follow up to check and see if there's other stores that are getting low on stock or out of stock. If you've checked with your local Apple retail store and had a similar response, let me know, send me an email, and I'll try and follow up on this. As far as other changes coming in Lion, iCloud is one of those other things that a lot of people are wondering about. John Gruber said something interesting this week. He thinks that iCloud is actually going to be used to auto-resolve sync conflicts. So anybody who's done calendar syncing or contact syncing through Mobile Me, you're familiar with that dialogue that pops up when there's a conflict that says, which do you want to select? Do you want to select the version that's in Mobile Me or the local one? And which one do you want to overwrite? He says, we're not going to see that dialogue anymore. What Apple's going to do is auto resolve those conflicts through iCloud and then use versioning, the versioning technology, which is built into macOS 10 Lion, but he's saying a similar technology built on the server side in iCloud that would allow you to go back. So if it made a mistake, if it grabbed the wrong version, you could go back through those versions in the iCloud and pull back the correct one and resync that one. Some of the logic being used around this is that Apple, or that Steve Jobs said in the keynote that, quote, the truth is in the cloud, and that truth being that Apple knows best which version. It's a little bit scary to think of them auto-resolving conflicts, because if you don't notice that conflict, how far back is that versioning going to go? And you could end up with some incorrect data, and anybody who's been through a bad syncing experience probably has horror stories or horror thoughts, I guess, thinking about this sort of thing. But it'd be nice to not see that dialogue box anymore. Another thing that I read this week is that iCloud gives you 5 gigabytes of storage, but just like the current version of MobileMe, that's kind of this shared storage. So you use it for your documents, you use it for email, and that could be a problem for some people who save a lot of emails on the server, because once your 5 gigabytes of storage is full, your email stops working, or at least it does with the current version of iCloud. I would imagine you'll get some sort of warning that your storage is getting full and with an offer to buy more, or reminding you to maybe clean out some of your older files and data so this doesn't happen. That's pretty typical for most online mail services. I know through my internet service provider, if my mailbox fills up, it starts bouncing emails. So it doesn't surprise me that that would happen with iCloud, but just something to be aware of if you're considering upgrading. Another big thing that's been resolved this week, and it was a question a lot of people had, was going to be, are iCloud services available through web interfaces? So things like web-based email that we have in MobileMe, access to your contacts and calendars. Some reports, earlier reports, were saying that Apple was going to do away with those services in iCloud and we weren't going to have them anymore. Apple has confirmed they are going to have web interfaces for mail, contacts, calendar, and Find My iPhone. The three things that are going away in their current forms are iWeb hosting. So if you use iWeb and you host your website through your MobileMe account, that's going to be going away. Also, your MobileMe photo galleries, that's going to be replaced by the photo syncing and streaming service, and iDisk. The iDisk one, you're going to be able to transfer your iDisk over to iCloud file storage, but it's going to be a different thing. So you're not going to be accessing it in the same way. Apple's doing this more push sync technology. So yes, iDisk in its current form is going away, but it's going to be replaced by something different. Technologies like iWeb hosting, that's not being replaced. Apple's telling everybody you need to move your hosting to some other service. So whether that's GoDaddy or Bluehost or DreamHost, one of those companies, you're going to have to sign up and then use FTP that's built into iWeb to push your websites out to that. iWeb, the product itself, nobody really knows if the software is going to be going away. It's certainly going to be usable into the near future. And as far as the transition for these services going away and being moved to iCloud, they're going to be around till June 30th, 2012. So you have a whole year to get through this stuff. And Apple has actually posted an FAQ with links and articles on how to transition your stuff. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com, or you can just search up on Apple's support website and find that. As for when we're going to see Lion hit the Mac App Store, told you earlier, it's looking like it could be any day now. There's been two dates being thrown around this week, either July 6th or July 19th being the rumored dates. The earlier date seems to have more clout to me, given the fact that Apple has just announced that July 19th will be when they announce their third quarterly results for 2011. So they typically don't have major releases on the same day that they're doing their quarterly results call. Usually updates come right before that. So I'm putting my money on a July 6th release. The only thing in the back of my mind that's kind of eating at me is typically when Apple says they're releasing on a given month, it tends to happen toward the end of the month, but none of the rumors seem to be saying that it's going to be toward the end of July. So let's go with July 6th for now. So if you've been waiting for Lion, could be happening as early as next week, right after the U.S. 4th of July holiday. Apple pushed out new versions of the AirPort and the Time Capsule recently. Not a whole lot of details on what changed in the models. There's new storage sizes for the Time Capsule, a 2GB model and a 3GB model, selling for $299 US and $499 US respectively. There was a new model on the AirPort, but no spec changes. We had heard earlier on about Apple potentially upgrading to a new A5-powered AirPort. I don't think that happened in this model. I'm still hopeful that Apple's making some changes to support what I'm calling a LAN cloud or a local area network version of iCloud, basically fitting into this whole PC-free technology, giving you a way to store your iOS files on a device locally within your home rather than just in the iCloud and do syncing. And I think an AirPort or Time Capsule would be a perfect device for that, because you could hook a USB hard drive into that, have your iPad, and use web dev technologies to store files and documents and things like that on that product. So I'm thinking maybe there were some updates in there for that, but a French Mac site tore down the 2GB Time Capsule recently and found that it has a standard Western Digital Caviar Green hard drive in it. Now, Apple advertises the Time Capsule as having a server-grade hard drive. I guess they're taking a lot of leeway with what might be a server-grade. Server-grade is typically dependent upon the what's called the mean time between failure, so how long a hard drive can run on average before it reaches failure point. I don't know if the Western Digital drives fall within that specification to classify it as server, but a lot of consumers, if you ask them, would say that Western Digital Caviar Green drives are not server-based drives. So Apple may have some marketing to change there. The other thing on the Time Capsules that seems ridiculous to me is if you look at the pricing, 2GB at $299, that's probably not so bad, but another $200 to get one more gig of storage, that is a real price premium. Apple has taken hits in the past for charging too much for RAM. This is ridiculous to charge that much more for another gig of hard drive storage. So if you're considering one of the new Time Capsules, you might go with the 2GB model and then just attach an external hard drive via USB, which you can do for additional storage to upgrade, because you can go out and get a 2TB drive, I think for around $100, depending on the model that you're looking for. So go that route, save yourself a little bit of money. But updates to the AirPort and Time Capsule, we're going to have to wait till more sites do teardowns. I haven't seen an iFixit teardown of the new airport to find out if there's some new technologies under the hood, so stay tuned for that. Just in case you missed it, Apple did push an update to its current operating system, Snow Leopard. macOS 10.6.8 update was released through Apple's software update utility. As far as what's in it, the enhancements include updates to the Mac App Store to get your Mac ready for the upgrade to macOS 10 Lion. So further evidence that there's a Lion update looming, although we really cut in a lot of ways already knew that. Resolves an issue that may cause preview to unexpectedly quit. Improves support for IP version 6, improves VPN reliability, identifies and removes known variants of the Mac Defender malware, added additional RAW support for newer digital cameras. That's a typical upgrade that Apple does when it pushes out new point releases. And what I'm calling a metric crud load of security patch updates. You can go on Apple's site and see the full list, but they updated a lot of security things with 10.6.8. If you're still on Leopard, the good news is they also pushed out security updates for you. Security update 2011-004 was released for macOS 10 Leopard, so you're going to want to grab that if you're still using that version of the operating system. An unannounced update in 10.6.8 that came out later in the week was that Apple finally added trim support for SSD drives, and that had been something that a lot of people who use SSD were looking for. The reason it's so important is that traditionally operating systems are built for spinning drives, and they operate in a certain way. Flash-based drives or solid-state drives are a lot different in how they handle the data and the blocks and the pages and stuff like that. But without going into a lot of technical detail, essentially when you get a new solid-state drive and you format it, it's clean and you start writing files to it and it writes them in a certain way. And as things fill up and you start to delete drives, if you don't have or delete files, if you don't have trim support, performance of that drive can slow down. So the trim technology takes care of that, kind of cleaning up things and managing files in a different way that's more optimized for flash-based hard drives. So it was important for Apple to add that support. Now, the one thing we're hearing, Cult of Mac has been reporting that third-party SSD drives, the ones not purchased through Apple with the system, might not be supported in the 10.6.8 update. There's rumors that Lion is going to have full support for trim for SSD. Apple's obviously moving that way with its hard drives moving to more and more solid state. So it makes sense that they're going to be rolling that into the operating system. But important to note that 10.6.8 was the first time when we saw an official trim support from Apple. There's some third-party updates out there, I think, that you can get to the operating system that also supports the trim. I ran across an interesting article over at the unofficial Apple weblog. It was actually an email from, I think, one of their readers, or a case put forward by one of their readers that has to do with the iPod Touch potentially being replaced. I'll have a link to the full article in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, you were saying that a low-cost iPhone could replace the iPod Touch for Apple. And they had a bunch of bullet points that I wanted to run through and just talk a little bit about why I think this makes sense. They said, according to iSupply, which is a company that breaks down the components within different products and sort of adds up what the cost to manufacture that is, the pure cost of just the parts, they say the component costs that make up a 16 gigabyte iPhone cost Apple about $188. That needs to be taken with a grain of salt because they don't really know exactly what Apple's contracts are, but let's just assume that that's right. Production of the iPhone 5 is supposed to start in July, with the launch potentially coming out in September. September is typically the time frame when Apple does reveal new versions of iPod software. So the fact that Apple has pushed that date back might be significant when you're making this case. iOS 5 is going to come out at the same time, and typically iOS does come along with new iPhone hardware. So we are expecting that new iPhone in September. So far, there's been no mention or no rumors of anybody saying there's new iPod Touches in the work to go along with iOS 5. Again, depending on the reports that you're reading, there's not expected to be a lot of huge design changes in the iOS 5. It's going to be pretty much similar to the iPhone 4, with the exception of maybe a processor upgrade and a switch to a universal 3G chipset, the GSM CDMA design coming together like we've seen in the iPad 2 on Verizon. Unlocked iPhones recently started to be on sale in the U.S., so that's marks the first time Apple is moving in that direction. We've been hearing these rumors that the iPhone 5 might have the same 5-megapixel camera sensor that's currently in the iPhone 4, rather than that 8-megapixel design, which would bring costs down. So Apple focusing on cutting production costs. And this year's back-to-school promotion came out, and it's a $100 iTunes gift card, not the typical free iPod Touch that Apple throws along with new Mac purchases for back to school. So they're saying you add all these things up and you take a look at them as a whole, and it seems to point to potentially Apple not selling an iPod Touch anymore. And I can see the point they're trying to make. I'm not sure I 100% agree with it. I think what Apple might be doing is taking a look at the iPod Touch and moving it more toward, I don't want to say a small iPad, but that's essentially what it becomes. And they could use some of the iPhone designs and technologies, the current 3GS, to develop this low-cost 3G-enabled media player, which is in essence what you're going to end up with. And there's a lot of evidence that seems to support that. If you look at what Apple is doing with iOS 5, they've made that consistent between the iPhone and the iPod Touch, separating the music player app on the iPhone side, so it's going to be just like the iPod Touch. So they're kind of converging some of these things together. And if you throw the ability to do 3G or even 4G with this universal CDMA GSM chipset into a device like an iPod Touch, you can now have it access data networks like the iPads do. So you can have that kind of 3G option to access data, and more applications, what Apple is doing with iCloud, that's going to become dependent upon having an always-on internet connection. So I think Apple may retool the platform for building iPhone 4s or even the iPhone 3GS, add in some newer technologies like 3G chipsets, and make a new type of iPod Touch, call it an iPod Touch 4G, that they could sell for around $199 off contract, have the ability to enable things like access to cellular data networks, and have a very compelling and interesting product. And it seems like the next logical upgrade for the iPod Touch. So it makes a lot of sense. It would give the buyers the ability to have this on-demand, pay-as-you-go access to data networks, and that could be good not only for Apple, but also for the cellular carriers, who maybe you have a parent who wants to get a device for their kid. They want them to be able to have access to email and data and web surfing, but they don't want to have the phone bits. They don't want to have the messaging. And I'm going to throw on top of that, I just thought of this now, look at something like iMessage, which is now able to go from iOS device to iOS device as long as it's connected. And if you can have cellular data access, you can send iMessages, essentially SMSs, but not have to pay the SMS charges. Carriers might not like that so much, but I think they're going to look at, hey, we can have more people on data plans, and ultimately that's going to be a good thing for our bottom line. So I think any way you look at this, it does seem to make a lot of logical sense and does seem like the next evolutionary step. And Apple wants to rapidly grow its base of iOS devices. There was an interesting report that came out this week from Nielsen. We've been hearing that Android is gaining a lot of growth. It's surpassing iOS in terms of user base in the US and globally. And I think that's going to continue to happen. But Nielsen noticed that over the past 3 months, new iPhone ownership grew from 10% to 17%, while Android's growth remained flat at 27%. So they had 27% of the market in terms of new users 6 months ago, over the last 3 month period, they still only had 27%, while Apple's numbers went up about 7%. So Android still has a significant lead in terms of total share, but Apple continues to grow and Android seems to be stagnant. So if Apple can continue to add more devices and more connected devices, that's going to be ultimately good for the 3GS. And as far as where that growth came from, some of the suggestion is that by Apple expanding its carrier network to Verizon, they were able to grab more customers. And that seems to have leveled off according to a lot of the reports that I'm reading. But Apple still has a number of carriers, Sprint and T-Mobile. I guess T-Mobile is eventually going to become AT&T, so maybe by attrition they're going to grab more customers, but they're going to be able to grow their base by opening up more devices to more carrier networks and lowering prices on iPhones. So that's another thing that we're hearing a lot about, is that we could see a lower cost iPhone. Apple already sells the 3GS on contract for $49 in the US. Saw some reports that Apple could be moving to a point where they have those models available for free after the iPhone 5 releases. I don't think that Apple's going to want to sell a two-generation-old piece of hardware, so I think we could see an iPhone 4 that's at a low price point or even potentially free, and again, that's going to continue to grow this base. If Apple does move in this direction where they have more and more connected devices, and especially more and more connected devices on cellular networks, the one thing I'm feeling is going to be a real challenge for Apple and consumers is getting the carriers to expand their networks and make access to data and more data in terms of bandwidth available to consumers. We did see this past week Verizon, or rumors of what Verizon's capped data plans are going to look like. It's pretty well believed that Verizon's moving to capped data plans sometime in July, sounding like around July 7th, and what they're going to be offering are three different options for smartphones: 2 gigabytes of data for $30 a month, 5 gigabytes for $50 a month, or 10 gigabytes for $80 a month. So a little bit higher if you look at each plan compared to AT&T in the States, although they are offering that higher tier, the 10 gigabyte, $80 a month plan for higher bandwidth users or higher consumers of data. And they do have personal hotspot options built into that at $20 a month. And that does, just like AT&T, add another 2 gigabytes to your data plan. But unlimited is going away. If you're currently on Verizon and you have an unlimited data plan, the rumor is you are going to be able to be grandfathered in. But if it ends up being like AT&T, they're going to keep trying to push you to those capped data plans, and they use the personal hotspot feature as a way to kind of do that. And on AT&T, I'm grandfathered in on the unlimited data plan. I like having it. I like having the option, especially with something like iCloud on the horizon, where I know I'm going to be consuming a lot more data. But if I want to use personal hotspot, I have to go to one of the new capped plans, and I'm not so certain I can live with that. So Apple's going to have a challenge working with the carriers if they're going to have more 3G, 4G connected devices out to get those data caps raised. And especially with things like iTunes Match looming and iCloud, users are going to only be using more and more data. So something is going to have to give here. And I don't know how that's all going to work. But if you're on Verizon, you want to be aware of those new plans, those new capped plans coming soon. So we've talked about new Macs, we've talked about new iPhones, and I guess the last thing to bring up would be new iPads. There's still debate on whether or not the next generation iPad will have a Retina display, whether Apple's going to double the resolution, quadruple the resolution, do a third of the resolution. Again, rumors are all over the board on this one. There have been rumors most recently that Apple is going to double the resolution of the display, moving it to 2048 by 1536 pixels. Whether that's going to be branded as an iPad 3 or not, that's still up in the air. It makes the most sense. If you're looking at all the rumors, it does make sense for Apple to double that resolution, because that makes it so assets could scale naturally, and it is a good even number for the display to work at. The dilemma there is Apple sort of defined the specification for Retina being 300 pixels per inch in terms of the pixel density at doubling the resolution, 2048 by 1536, it brings the pixels per inch on that display up to about 260, a little bit more, give or take, 260 pixels per inch, which is close, but doesn't quite meet that 300 PPI criteria. Now, supporting the fact that maybe Apple doesn't need to go that high, fully up to 300 pixels per inch on the resolution, DisplayMate did some tests and with the current iPad display, the display in the iPad 2, and they said in most cases, it beats all of the competitors on the market, and some of those already have a higher resolution display. Their tests included measurements of things like screen reflections, brightness, contrast, the colors, intensities, different viewing angles, backlight, so they hit a bunch of points in their testing, and the iPad won in most categories. So DisplayMate was making the argument that a Retina display on the iPad might not even be worth it because it could actually have negative impacts on performance versus how much it would actually benefit the display quality. And in reading the report, I tend to kind of agree with some of their arguments. It seems like we're getting into another one of these bullet point wars or these specification wars when it comes to tablets, and that doesn't necessarily mean good things for the consumers. Just upping the resolution or your pixel count or your density isn't always going to be the best thing for a product experience. It's becoming similar to the megapixel war we're seeing on cameras. Apple, I think, has proven that the highest megapixel camera sensor doesn't always mean the best quality camera sensor, and I think they're going to want to try and do a similar thing with the display technologies. We need to build displays that make sense for the different devices, and Apple has a good history of doing that. So DisplayMate argued that you could have a 200 PPI display or pixel per inch display and then improve your subpixel anti-aliasing in software and come up with a display that pretty closely mirrors a higher resolution display or something more approaching a Retina style display. There was a strange rumor out there that Apple might be going with a 33% higher display for the iPad 3. That resolution would be 1366 by 1024. And that would make sense given some of the things DisplayMate put in their report, but it doesn't make sense in terms of compatibility with existing applications or making it easy for developers to transition their applications to a newer high-res display. I think we're going to see Apple do something like they did with the iPhone 4, the doubling pixel resolution. That makes it easy. And we've already seen Apple include some assets in iOS 5, specifically with the Twitter client that seemed to support a 2048 by 1536 pixel resolution. Is that going to show up in an iPad 3? And is that going to happen this year? I really don't think so. I don't think we can expect an iPad 3 this year, although just today or yesterday, we started hearing some rumors from DigiTimes that Apple might be giving us a new iPad 3 in September. But earlier, DigiTimes also reported that Apple wasn't going to have a new iPad 3 this year, that their suppliers were just starting to get orders in place and stuff to start production, and that they wouldn't expect to see an iPad 3 until early next year, early 2012. So conflicting reports, even from the same source, which really gets interesting. DigiTimes has always been hit or miss. The one thing that DigiTimes is reporting now that I think is probably accurate is they're expecting Apple to have shipped up to 12 million iPad 2s this spring, and that Apple is ramping up production to ship or send out 14 million iPad 2s over the summer. So I think this continues to support the fact that Apple is not going to put out an iPad 3 this year. Unless their sales really start to tank toward the end of the summer on iPad 2s, there really isn't any financial incentive for Apple to put out a new model. Sales of the iPad 2 are going strong. There's no real competitors that seem to be coming on board to kind of challenge Apple's dominance. So I think they can stick with their current design. And the longer they can do that, it's better for Apple's bottom line because component costs go down. They can continue to use the same stuff in the same production lines. We know they're going to expand production into Brazil very soon, so they're going to be able to really produce a lot of iPad 2s, and I don't see any compelling reason for them to change things. I think they're going to stick on the release cycle of a new iPad every year, so I would expect we won't hear Apple say anything about a new iPad 3 until early 2012 with a release around that April-May timeframe. And look at that. I told you we had a lot to cover, so much, in fact, that I actually skipped over one of my stories, and actually a very important one. Big news this week, Apple finally released to the Mac App Store the new version of Final Cut Pro. Final Cut Pro 10 was launched. It's available for $299 exclusively on the Mac App Store. If you want Motion and Compressor, those two products are now separate applications. They're available for purchase also through the Mac App Store, $49.99 for Motion 5, $49.99 US, and $49.99 for Compressor 4. Final Cut Express is no longer available. It's replaced by Final Cut Pro 10. Also, Final Cut Pro Server is gone, so it's all under one product. In looking at it, it seems to borrow a lot from iMovie in terms of the user interface, which seems to be putting off traditional video editors. There's also a lot of stuff that's been removed from the product, and it's mixed on terms of what Apple's going to do about some of those features. It's a major radical redesign, and it's definitely getting some mixed reviews. The workflows are based on three main areas: editing, media organization, and post-production. Some of the features include full 64-bit support, which is significant, a magnetic timeline, clip connections, compound clips, and auditions, the ability to do auto content analysis. So that's the thing like in iMovie where it can tell you how many people are in a shot or whether it's a wide shot or a close-up, things like that. You have smart collections. There's now integrated audio editing, so no Soundtrack Pro. There's no separate sound editing application. And you have color grading built in. So Final Cut Pro 10 is really seeming like a completely ground up rethinking of how we do video editing. It's very similar to the change, or it's feeling very similar to the change that Apple made when it transitioned iMovie from iMovie HD to the current version of iMovie, and that has upset a lot of traditional video editors, a lot of traditional users of Final Cut Pro. There seems to be this divide forming between different camps, and it's something that's still kind of being sorted out. The one advantage Apple might have with now distributing exclusively through the Mac App Store is it seeming like they're going to do rapid feature releases and updates. They're going to be rolling in new stuff. But to some people, it's seeming like Apple has released a product that's not quite fully baked, which is very unusual in terms of how Apple has traditionally done things. So they might be changing a little bit on that side. As far as hardware requirements go, it does seem to require at least a newish Mac. So it's leaving some older Macs out in the cold. The hardware requirements say that you're going to have basically a two-year-old or newer model. Earlier models are kind of coming up not up to snuff. The main issue is that you need an OpenCL-capable graphics card with at least 256 megabytes of RAM. There is an NVIDIA GeForce GT120 graphics upgrade kit for the Mac Pro, so if you have one of those early 2009 models, you can upgrade your graphics card for about $149, although you might have a hard time getting that. I had read some reports that Apple was back-ordered or still not shipping those don't have those upgrades readily available. Interestingly, the Intel integrated graphics, the HD graphics, seem to be supported. So if you have the Intel HD graphics 3000 card or later, that should work for you. The App Store won't actually let you buy the software if you don't have a Mac that meets the specifications, but there have been some reports that if you can make the purchase on a supported Mac and copy it over, there are some models that technically Apple says aren't supported, but it will run on, probably with a pretty significant performance hit, but you can at least get it up and running with it. As I mentioned, there's been a lot of backlash from editors in the pro community, and there are sides forming. Apple has posted an FAQ on their website to address some of the concerns and misconceptions, or what Apple feels are misconceptions. They've moved a lot of things around. So because of the new user interface, some of the things that are happening is editors can't find the features that they're used to using. In other cases, the features are completely gone, and it's up in the air whether Apple will replace all or most of the features that a lot of users have come to rely on, which is why there's sort of this rift forming. One of the most significant changes that is not going to get updated is that you can no longer import your old Final Cut Pro 7 projects into Final Cut Pro 10. And that is a big deal. If your workflow has been dependent on Final Cut Pro and you want to transition to the new product and you can't bring over your new projects, that's significant. Now, Apple is saying, well, you can continue to run Final Cut Pro 7 alongside, but this is our new format, this is our new platform, and you're going to need to move over to that if you want to use it. You can bring in your video elements from those projects, you just can't bring over the project files themselves. Also, multi-camera support isn't in Final Cut Pro 10. That's a significant feature that a lot of people are upset about, but Apple did say that is something they're working on and should be coming in a later update or release. Another big one for some video editors is tape-based workflows have really changed. They're generally out of the new product, so if you're going in and out of tape, you're going to have to rely on some third-party add-ons and utilities, specifically for things like deck control software, and Apple's working with some vendors to bring that support. Also, reference monitors is another thing that isn't supported. Multiple monitors are supported, but a lot of video editors use standard CRT kind of reference monitors to work on their projects, and you're going to have to rely on some third-party solutions for that. So those are the types of things that a lot of traditional editors are getting up in arms about. I'm actually working on putting together a full roundtable podcast for the MacCast. I'm not a pro video editor, so I want to delve into these issues with some experts. So I'm going to get some people from both sides. Ones who really like the new Final Cut Pro 10 and like the changes and things that Apple are doing, and some more traditional editors who aren't quite as happy. We're going to get them all on a Skype call and have a little back and forth and try and dig really deep into this. It's going to take me a week or two to set that up, but expect that on a future episode of the MacCast. So if this is the world you live in, we're going to get you covered. And I'm pretty excited about putting that together. I'm lining up some great guests, so I think you're really going to enjoy it. So stay tuned on that. And then finally in the news for this week, Thunderbolt. Apple, according to all the rumors, is working to push out Thunderbolt on all of its models. We're expecting Thunderbolt peripherals to start showing up any day now, but we're going to need some cabling to connect those to our Macs. So Apple is finally now selling a Thunderbolt cable through their website and in their retail stores. It's $49 US. It came out along with a new Thunderbolt RAID from Pegasus, so you actually have something to hook on the other end of that Thunderbolt cable. Along with the cable, Apple also released an FAQ on its support website to kind of answer some questions about technically what the Thunderbolt cable brings and does. It does utilize two separate 10 gigabit per second links, one for the display side and one for the PCIe side for connecting devices. I don't know what that means for traffic. I'm trying to dig into the details. I haven't found anybody who has said whether or not if you don't have a display connected, can you use both 10 gigabit links up and down for your devices. That was one of the key things when Apple announced the technology, that you could do synchronous data 10 gigabytes down and 10 gigabytes up at the same time. But if they separated one side out for the displays, is that still possible? I haven't really dug into that. If you happen to know or find an article about that, please shoot me an email and let me know. Apple does point out that if you're going to have different types of devices on your chain, that not everybody is going to support the fastest rates. So you're going to want to pay attention to what you're hooking up, and I've heard that order becomes important, that you're going to want your faster devices, your faster Thunderbolt devices further up the chain. So for example, if you're going to hook up an older FireWire 800 device in your chain, you want to make sure that that comes after your Thunderbolt devices, because you can chain these things together. There are going to be adapters and things for hooking up older technologies, USB 2, USB 3, well, USB 3 is a new technology, but hooking up USB 3 devices, FireWire 400 and 800 devices, and anything in that chain can affect the overall performance and speed. Apple says you're going to be able to use the disk activity tab in the activity monitor to kind of check and monitor your rates, so you're going to want to do that if you're hooking up multiple devices. Also, when you're hooking up multiple devices, Apple says 2 meters is the recommended cable length for Thunderbolt cables if you're looking to gain best performance. I'm assuming that means 2 meters between any two devices, not for the total length of the chain. You can boot and use target disk mode via Thunderbolt. So if you have an external hard drive, you can use those. And Apple did point out that if you want to use an iMac in target display mode, that's the feature in the new 27-inch iMacs. When you hook it up on the mini display port, you can actually use it as an external monitor for another Mac. If you're going to do that, you have to use a standard mini display port cable. That's not supported over a Thunderbolt cable. Again, you're going to want your devices, your display devices, at the very end of your Thunderbolt chain. You can use Thunderbolt with Windows under Boot Camp, although it's not an ideal experience. I have to say that. They point out that you do need to have the device connected and turned on when you boot up Windows in order for it to be recognized. And when you have Thunderbolt devices connected running in Boot Camp under Windows, it's going to prevent your Windows machine from going to sleep. And that's because if you eject the device or if it goes to sleep, the Thunderbolt connection will be lost and you're going to have to reboot with the Thunderbolt device on to have it show back up in Windows. So I think that's a Windows thing. They don't have quite full support for the Thunderbolt technology. I would imagine that would come out with some sort of software update as more and more Thunderbolt devices hit the market. Although I think we had heard that Thunderbolt really isn't coming to PCs until about 2012. So you might be waiting a little while longer for Microsoft and Windows to add Thunderbolt support. As far as why the cable is so expensive, I was shocked when I heard it was a $49 cable. Well, it turns out there's some pretty sophisticated technology inside the connectors on that cable. iFixit did a teardown of the cable, and it actually has 9 chips in the cable. 2 of them are Genium chips that are used to ensure the data performance and reliability over copper. So Apple has really worked hard to get the best performance out of that cable. So there are probably going to be some differences in the quality of different cables when they start to show up from third-party vendors. So you might consider making sure you do a little bit of research, and that I think Apple cables are going to be the best ones on the market, at least initially, until some other vendors come out with them. So you're going to have to probably pay a price premium on your Thunderbolt cables if you want the absolute best performance. But I would expect as Thunderbolt devices become more readily available, we'll see other vendors and other people putting out cables that match the quality and performance of what Apple has right now. Several companies, as a matter of fact, have announced support for Thunderbolt. We should start seeing those devices this summer, according to Apple. There's new stuff arriving all the time, so keep an eye on your feeds and on the websites to see what options are out there. And as I mentioned earlier and in prior episodes, a lot of you have asked me, am I going to be able to hook up my FireWire devices and my older devices? Absolutely yes. The technology supports all kinds of different cables and connectors, and you'll be able to get adapters and stuff like that for your older devices. The only thing you're going to have to pay attention to now is sort of how you hook things up and the performance of that, as I already stated. Along with the new cables and the announcement of the Pegasus Raid, Apple also did put out a firmware update for Thunderbolt-enabled Macs. So if you have one of those, you probably want to grab it through software update. It improves the performance and adds some stability fixes for Thunderbolt. And so you'll be good and ready when all those new devices hit the market. And that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to thank another one of our show sponsors, Stitcher. They make a really cool application for your iPhone, your iPod Touch, your iPad called Stitcher Smart Radio. They actually also have it available for Android devices, so if you want to check it out there. But essentially what you can do is you can listen to podcasts and radio stations on the go, all streaming without having to connect into iTunes, without having to sync, and it's a completely free application. It allows you to get all of that content on demand anytime, anywhere that you want. And so when new episodes of the MacCast become available, you can actually get a push notification, be notified that they're there, and launch Stitcher Smart Radio, go right to it, and you can get it delivered instantly to your device. Not only that, but right now, if you sign up and you use the code MACCAST for new Stitcher Radio listeners, they are offering the chance to win an iPad 2. So they're running a contest. So go download the application. You can also head to stitcher.com/MACCAST and get details and sign up for a reminder to go download the application. But once you have it downloaded and installed, launch it, use the code MACCAST, and you'll be entered to win that. It's a really cool app because you can use geolocation to get local radio stations, or you can even access radio stations outside your area. So if you're a transplant, you've moved from one part of the country to another, or even one part of the world to another place, and want to get different radio stations, you can get that right along with your podcasts, all without the hassles of having to sync and remember to update your device and stuff like that. So use the code MACCAST. Go to Stitcher.com/MACCAST for details. STITCHER.com/MACCAST. And a big thank you to Stitcher for their support of the show. I mentioned on the last show that I had some issues with my Macs recently. I had to take them into the Apple Store. And you know from listening to the MACCAST that I am huge about backup. So I really don't think a lot about this stuff. I don't worry about the fact that I need to take my system in and they might replace a hard drive or something like that. I don't worry about getting my data back because I have all of my backups. And so I brought it in not thinking I'd have to worry about anything. And then I ran into some little gotchas. So I'm going to come clean and admit to you some mistakes that I made in the hopes that maybe you don't make the same mistakes that I did. So one of the processes of my backup is doing a super duper clone that I can actually boot from. And the concept there is that if I need to take my system in and I need to use another one of my older Macs to continue working, I can simply boot off my external clone and work from that until I get my new system back. And generally that works really great. In the case of my MacBook Pro, that was fine. It worked fine. But I also had to take in an iMac, a 24-inch aluminum iMac. And when I got back and I went to boot from the clone for that, it wouldn't boot. And I thought, well, that's really strange. I don't understand why this isn't booting. I got worried that there was something wrong with the hard drive. Well, it turned out that in my super duper clone, I had the wrong partition map. And if you don't know what that is, when you go in and you get a new drive and you're preparing it to use as a backup drive or just put into your Mac, whatever, you're going to open up Disk Utility and you're going to want to format that. But important to that, you're also going to want to go to the partition tab or look down there at the bottom at whatever the partition map is and make sure that it's set up for the right scheme for whichever kind of Mac you have. Now, almost exclusively now, since we've been on Intel for so long, you're going to want to use the GUID partition map, and that will allow you to have a bootable drive that will support an Intel-based Mac. If you have it set up for Apple partition map, you're not going to be able to boot from that on Intel. You can boot from that if you have a PowerPC-based Mac. And for some reason, my super-duper clone for my iMac was formatted with an Apple partition map, which meant that I could not boot from it. The other thing that I did was I also needed to take an iPhone in. I think I mentioned that I have this iPhone 3GS that was having a speaker problem. And I had done all the things you're typically supposed to do. I had done the restore and restore from backup. But what I hadn't done is done the iPhone restore and not restored from the backup. So I took it into the store along with the iMac and with my MacBook Pro. So it was a long Genius Bar appointment. Took all these things in. And the genius asked me, well, can we restore this? You know, can we reset it and not restore from the backup? And I thought, yeah, no problem, because I've synced it already with the iMac and I have the backup at home, so I can just plug it in and put my data back on it when I get back home. Not realizing that, guess what? I was dropping off the iMac, which meant I had no machine to actually sync the iPhone with. So I had my iPhone wiped out, had all the data wiped off, it restored to factory new settings, but I didn't have any of my apps or any of my music or any of my data on there. And when I got back home, I had no way to put that stuff back on, and that iMac was going to be in the shop for 7 to 10 days. So I was kind of without it. The other thing that I did remember to do, and I'll remind you to do as well, is now, because we get so much stuff through iTunes and through the App Store, make sure that you deauthorize your iTunes, that you deauthorize the Mac App Store so you don't eat up your authorizations. Or actually, in that case, I think you log out of MobileMe or log out of your Apple ID account before you take it in. And that's going to help you especially if you're going to be working off a bootable clone or something like that while your Mac is in the shop. If you do boot from your clone, a couple other things you might consider doing is, one, disabling Time Machine, because you're going to have that machine eventually come back from the shop and you're going to restore it from your backups, and you may get into an out of sync situation. In my case, I disable Time Machine. I also disable my cloud backups. Now, you know how paranoid I am about backups. So what I typically do is set up a second backup strategy, usually just a super duper clone, to have in place while I'm working on that temporary system. So that's what I did in this case. I brought out my old Mac Mini. I was able to boot from my super duper backup for my MacBook Pro, which is my primary machine, and work off that for a couple days while my Mac was going to be in the shop. As it turned out, they replaced my MacBook Pro with a brand new model. So I think I mentioned that on the last show. If I didn't, remind me and I'll tell you the whole story. But yeah, remember to do that, and then just know that when you get your Mac back, you're going to have to reauthorize your iTunes and all of your purchases and stuff like that. But that's a small price to pay for being able to work while your Mac is actually off in the shop. So that was my experience, and I just wanted to to share that with you. I recently did an episode for MacCast members, and it's come up a couple times on this show that when macOS 10 Lion is released, it's no longer going to have support for Rosetta. That's the ability to run applications that were built for PowerPC that are not universal applications or not Intel native applications. And I went through all of the different options that you would have for running your applications once you've upgraded to Lion, if they're still Rosetta applications, and how to identify those applications as Rosetta applications. So you can go sign up for the membership podcast at member.maccast.com if you want to hear that. But in essence, the quick summary is you're going to have to either run an older machine, or you're going to have to upgrade your applications or find alternatives, things like that. Those were kinds of some of the items that we covered. And if you want to be able to test your applications now, sort of get ready for or prep yourself for Lion coming out and find out which applications might not work, you can actually go in and identify them either using the Finder. Just go into your applications, select the applications, and do a git info, and you can check it there. Or you can use the System Profiler, the application section in there, to find any apps on your Mac that might require Rosetta or just PowerPC only applications. But I got a great tip also from Terry, who followed up with me, on how you can actually disable Rosetta in Snow Leopard if you've installed it from the command line. And this tip comes via macOS 10 hints. And then you can actually test out your applications today. So you can turn off Rosetta, continue working on your Mac, and then see which applications might give you an issue. What'll happen is it'll pop up and it'll tell you that you need to install Rosetta if you have an application that requires it. So I'll have a link in the show notes. I'll also have some information in the show notes as to the specific command line that you can run. But in essence, what happens is when that dialog pops up, what it's running is a special little binary that's in your user libexec folder. One is called Rosetta non grata, and if that is set up to be called, that means that it will pop up that dialog. If you're already running Rosetta, it actually runs a library or a binary called translate. So Terry was able to do this, and he was able to test his Canon printer, because one of the things that you might not think about, you can kind of go through and see your applications, but it might not be readily obvious which print drivers have been upgraded to support Intel native or be universal. So Terry pointed out that while his Canon print drivers were all updated, another concern is that sometimes the installers for those drivers require Rosetta. So the installers haven't been updated. So you could upgrade to Lion, and even though your drivers have been updated, they might not, you might not be able to install them. Now, typically they should get pulled down through Apple's software update utility, but depending on which printer you have, which model you have, and Apple's integration for that within the operating system, that may or may not work. So some options: if you run into trouble after upgrading to Lion, you could pull your drivers back from a Time Machine backup, but the worst option would be that you'd have to completely reinstall Lion from scratch, starting with Snow Leopard, then installing the drivers, then loading Lion on top of it. So you can see, as we were talking about earlier, Apple's going to have some challenges with people doing clean installs and upgrades if the only way to get Lion installed on your system is from Snow Leopard, from installing Snow Leopard first, and it sounds like that's going to be the process. So doing clean installs could get a whole lot more complicated once Lion is released. Another tip I suggested for running older applications in macOS 10 was to hook up an old Mac and then use a KVM switch, a keyboard video and mouse switch, to move your keyboard and mouse back and forth between the different systems. Now, that typically requires a wired keyboard. I don't think there's KVMs that support Bluetooth, but I could be wrong on that. Another option could be that you run it completely what's called headless and use something like VNC or some remote control software, Apple's built-in remote control software, to go in and just use the Rosetta applications on the other system sort of virtually using screen sharing. But Nigel also reminded me about a great project called Teleport from Abyssoft, and I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Essentially what this does, and I believe it leverages the VNC technology, but he has already tested it. He confirmed that it works under Lion. What it allows you to do is, if you have two Macs, you can use a single mouse and keyboard and move seamlessly between those two. It'll actually work over the network to detect when you've transitioned from one machine to the other with your mouse and move keyboard and mouse control to that system. So that's a Donationware application. If you do use it, I would recommend you sending a donation to Abyssoft so that they continue to develop that product, because it's really kind of a cool technology. It works almost seamlessly, and that way you could use a Bluetooth mouse and keyboard to kind of act as a virtual KVM switch. A number of people have also asked me about running Snow Leopard as a virtual machine using, say, Parallels or VMware. As far as I know, without doing some serious kind of hacking, you can't really get that to work. And I think even in hacking it, you have to run it under VMware in Windows. On macOS 10, the only way it's supported is if you actually run Snow Leopard Server. And that could be a pretty pricey option, because I think Snow Leopard Server runs about $500. But if you have a copy of Snow Leopard Server running around, you could install that under the virtual machine using Parallels or VMware, and then install your Rosetta applications under that. There was finally a rumor that surfaced. One of the big applications that's not going to work under Rosetta is the older version of Quicken, which a lot of people continue to use and like. There was some rumors that Apple might license the Rosetta technology for developers to embed within their applications, so they wouldn't actually have to convert them over to Universal, which in some cases could be a very costly proposition for supporting not a number of users. Certainly should be technically possible. I think it's probably unlikely. Apple really wants to move on. I don't think there's a lot of money in them licensing the Rosetta technology to other companies, so I just don't see it being significant for their bottom line. If you want to know which applications are Lion compatible, Rosetta or not, you sort of getting prepared for the release of Lion, there is a website called roaringapps.com, roaringapps.com, and you can check there, and they're updating a long list of all of the applications that they're finding are currently compatible with Lion. Now, remember, Lion still isn't out yet, so the final release might support more applications, or there might be applications that get updated when Lion becomes available. You're going to want to run your software update or purchase apps through the Mac App Store to make sure they're up to date and support Lion. But just some additional details on testing for Rosetta and getting Lion support since it will be out probably in the next week or two. With what Apple has announced in Lion and iOS and sort of the convergence of those two technologies, along with the combination of iCloud, something we've been discussing a lot in the Mac community is Apple seems to be moving away from a traditional Finder in terms of file management and moving to some sort of system where applications are kind of document aware. They know that they have certain documents that they can interact with and access, more of this sort of iTunes, photo model where you go into the application and everything you need to interact with in terms of files and documents and stuff like that is contained within there. You do your file management within those applications. We saw that update happen in Final Cut Pro 10. And some people really don't like that model or aren't comfortable with that model, but it seems to be the direction that Apple's moving in, and it's getting a lot of us to think about file systems and how we deal with documents and work with things on our Macs. And talked a little bit about it on some episodes of the MacCast, but Kurt sent me an email and made some good points. He said, you know, you get a computer to do stuff, not to actually manage files. But if you think about it, we spend so much of our time currently with our devices kind of dealing with that, managing with files, worrying about where files are stored, kind of trying to handle those, get them organized, put them in little folders and stuff like that. And I think that's the kind of thing that Apple wants to move us away from. But he also pointed out that what happens when you have a folder, you're used to this concept that you want to have one folder that contains all kinds of different documents from different applications and things like that and organize them into a project. A lot of people think about things that they're working on and how they do stuff on their computer as projects or things, collections of things that I'm bringing together. And when I started thinking about that, I think Apple's solution or answer to that is going to be metadata. Also, possibly adding tags is going to become really important. And Apple's going to do a lot of this stuff, I think, in the background. They're going to scan through files. They're going to be indexing things. I think Spotlight technology is something that Apple's been working on for years. It's kind of come to maturity, and Apple's going to be integrating that. It's going to be very important in this sort of post-Finder world. And again, if you look to Final Cut Pro 10, we did see that it has some hints of this. A lot of the organization is going to be based on keywording and metadata and stuff like that. And you'll be able to pull, I think, projects together using those concepts rather than these traditional concepts of like kind of sticking everything in a folder. So if you think about this, like we would think about albums or playlists at a file level, again, turning to iPhoto or iTunes as an example, you can still organize your things into collections within that application, but you're only going to want to see elements that make sense for the application that you're working in. So think about project kind of groups. Each application could show you the relevant documents for that application, but then also group in different views the elements that you might use within that project. So I'm thinking of an example like Pages. It might only show you Pages documents when you're going to a file open dialog box, but if you're going to do an insert or need to access media and things like that, you're going to have something like a media browser, and it's going to be aware of where all of the different types of media that you might put into a Pages document, things like text and pictures, maybe other PDF files and stuff like that. It's going to be aware that Pages supports those types of files, and it's going to be able to bring those in. If you need to filter down to some sort of collection of just the things relevant to a project, you're going to have metadata or tags that you've added that say, this is a project, and these are all the files that are associated with this project, and bring that all together. And I think it's important to remember, too, this transition is happening slowly. Lion still has a Finder, a traditional Finder, and you're still going to be able to create folders and put things in projects and organize stuff that way. But I think Apple is playing with new concepts within applications, and we're really starting a beginning transition. And it makes sense when we look at devices like iOS devices that don't have a traditional Finder that we kind of need to rethink these concepts. But it's going to be a slow transition. It's not going to happen overnight, and I think Apple's going to get us used to the technologies. But I think all of this started with Spotlight. We're starting to see hints of it it started with Spotlight. It moved into iTunes and iMovie. We started seeing Apple playing around with those concepts. They're continuing to expand it as they move forward with iOS, and Apple continues to play with it. But I think ultimately, to not have to think about where documents are stored, that's another important element of this. iCloud comes into play because I don't need to know anymore that I have a document in the iCloud versus on my local area network server versus maybe stored locally on the flash or the hard drive on my Mac or iOS device. Your application is just going to be aware that these documents are out there, and when you need to fetch one, it's going to go get it for you. I think in the long run, it's going to be good for all of us. Apple is looking at the computers, as Kurt pointed out, from how do we do stuff? Let's not get bogged down in the management. Let the operating system handle that for us, and then we can continue to just work, and what we need will be ready and available when we need it. It's not going to be an easy process, but I think Apple will do a nice job in making that work for us. One of the new features that's in iOS 5 that I mentioned on a prior show that I'm excited about is the photo editing features, the ability to actually crop and rotate and stuff like that right in the built-in application. I have some third-party apps that are great for that, but it'd be nice to do it right as you take the shot or as you're working within the operating system. Well, Tom emailed me to say that he has a trick for kind of doing that cropping now in the current photo app. Now, it's not going to be quite as robust as what's in iOS 5, but it might get you through in a pinch. I guess that's a little bit of a... oh, that's a bad pun, but I'm going to roll with it anyway. So what Tom said is he currently does is he goes into the photo application and he uses the pinch to zoom feature to position and crop the photo how he'd like it. And then he uses the built-in ability to take a screenshot to actually crop that image or save that cropping. So the way that works is you pinch to zoom, get it cropped the way you like, and then press the home and sleep wake buttons simultaneously. That'll take a screenshot and save that right into your camera roll. Now, the main disadvantage of this trick is that the resulting image ends up being at the iPhone or the iPod Touch's screen resolution, so 960 by 640 in the case of the iPhone 4. So you're not going to have really high quality images. If you're using a 3GS, it's going to be 480 by 320, so relatively low resolution. But that might be good enough for sending an email or MMS or doing a Twitter or something like that of an image that's in your camera roll and could get you by in certain situations. So I thought that was a great little tip and wanted to share that with you. As I mentioned at the beginning of that tip, though, Apple is integrating cropping and scaling and stuff into its own application, and that is a feature set, or those are features that are also duplicated by a number of third-party photo editing applications. Ian sent me an email to express some concerns that I think are actually valid about what happens when Apple adds new features into its own applications, into the operating system, and starts integrating different types of innovations. And the reason for that concern is Apple's App Store policies, both on the Mac and on iOS. When Apple first announced that they were going to have an App Store, I had expressed some concerns. You can go back and listen to the episodes that Apple could use that to exert too much control over the whole app buying experience, or even further into the actual app creation experience, or the variety of applications that they're going to allow into the App Store, and therefore, by extension, allow customers access to. A couple of examples of this I'll point out is the current App Store rules for iOS seem to limit the ability to replicate or build into your application any features that are built into Apple applications or into the OS. For example, there's Rule 5.3 in the iOS App Store that says, apps which appear confusingly similar to an existing Apple product or advertising theme will be rejected. Now, I think in that case, it's specifically targeted at things that might look like Apple apps in terms of you're replicating the actual look and feel bit for bit, but there's a lot of interpretation. See how it's written kind of openly? Again, on the Mac App Store, there's Rule 2.7 that says apps that duplicate applications that are already in the App Store may be rejected, particularly if there's many of them. So that's the situation you've heard the often example given is that there's too many fart apps on the App Store, and Apple will stop any new fart apps because they have enough of them already. But that's really arbitrary. Who's to say that your application isn't better than your fart application isn't better than all the other ones that are in there? Well, Apple gets to kind of make that judgment call. And so now that the operating system is going to add things like, for example, Twitter integration, that's a big part of iOS 5, and Apple kind of showed that off. They're also bringing in Reading List into Safari, which works and looks a lot like Instapaper, which is a service that I really love and use. I love that application, and I'd hate to see that get blocked because Apple has integrated Reading List into Safari. And these are the kinds of concerns that Ian was bringing up. So photo editing, photo enhancement in iOS, does that mean Apple's going to start blocking some of the applications that offer just those features? Are developers going to have to expand their application to make it have more than what Apple brings. I think what scares me and Ian most is that they can, using these rules, they have the ability to block that stuff. But my gut instinct, my guess, is that in all but the most kind of edge or extreme egregious cases, Apple's really not going to start blocking application choice. I think the extreme examples will be situations where someone exactly rips off an Apple interface and tries to put that in their application, where they directly copy built-in functionality and don't offer anything additional or anything that expands upon what Apple is already providing. Twitter has kind of precedence for doing this a little bit, but I think they, again, haven't enacted or acted in a way to really stop it. They've kind of warned developers that they are, and I think that's kind of what Apple is doing, is they're saying, look, be careful about how you build applications. In Twitter's case, they asked developers to stop making Twitter clients, but there's still plenty of Twitter clients out there. We still see new ones surfacing. So is Apple's integration a Twitter client? No, it really isn't. It's just kind of a single sign-on that developers can then leverage within their applications to add Twitter support. So that's more of an enhancement. I don't think that's going to be replicating functionality. So I think Twitter clients are okay. And I think that's a good example because Apple's built-in stuff is mostly limited to limited, what I would call limited functionality or minor specific functionality. So in the case of photo editing in iOS, for example, it's just cropping, rotation. It's really simple things that are kind of logical evolutions for Apple to take with their photo app. You look at some of the photo clients out there or photo editors that are available for iOS, and they do much more than just those basic features. There are some just basic cropping tools, and you have to wonder, is Apple going to start blocking those? And I hope not. I really don't think they are, but they do seem to have the ability to do that. But there's lots of these examples, both in the Mac store and the iOS app store. For example, if you look at iPhoto and Aperture, well, they have photo editing capabilities. They have photo management capabilities, but Apple is not blocking things on the Mac app store yet. So Apple has a history, this history of sort of borrowing or even outright stealing ideas from other developers and other applications and then integrating them into the operating system. The difference now is they kind of have a mechanism now that we're going to be buying apps through the Mac App Store and the iOS App Store, start blocking their competition, since those are going to be the primary ways in the future, or it's seeming like in the future, that we get applications on our systems. Watson is a great example of where Apple basically outright stole ideas. Anybody who remembers that, Apple had a technology called Sherlock that allowed you to go out and search websites basically through like web services. And Watson added features and capabilities that Apple didn't have built into Sherlock. So one that I really liked was the ability to find movie times and get movie trailers and stuff like that. Well, Apple came out with a new version of Sherlock that basically replicated what Watson was doing. CoverFlow is another technology. Now, in that case, Apple actually bought the CoverFlow technology and integrated into the operating system, which I think is a better way to go. Another recent example is text snippet replacement. You can, built into the operating system in the system preferences, go in and set up little snippets of text that get replaced for doing things like adding accented words and stuff like that. That's duplicate functionality to what programs like Type It For Me and Text Expander offer, but they go much further than what Apple has built in. Apple's is a really basic integration, and again, is kind of evolutionary to the operating system. So I think Apple's trying to make the OS better. In some cases, it does seem like they rip off developers, but in most cases, I think these are logical evolutions of the operating system. One that's really not clear is that what is going to happen with reading list. At first, I think the developer, Marco Armont, was very concerned that Apple might start blocking him. But then in looking at it deeper, reading list is really something that's just added on to Safari, and it doesn't look like there's going to be an open API for putting it into other applications. So it's kind of like what Apple did with RSS feeds, adding those to Mail and Safari. You can use that feature in there, but they're not really blocking other RSS clients because Apple recognizes that users need to have a certain amount of choice. There's a big difference between can and will block applications, but I think there's a lot of power in having the option, and that's where some of this concern comes from. So ultimately, Ian, when thinking about this, I went back to history. You know, it's shown that logic and sort of calmer heads will prevail. One example I can think of is the Google Voice application in iOS. Apple initially blocked that. We don't know the specific details. I have a feeling that it had to do with the dialer that was built into Google Voice. Google Voice allows you to make outbound calls through their application. I think they were probably replicating too closely what Apple was doing in their own phone dialer, and Apple wasn't happy with that. Eventually, we did get the Google Voice application on iOS. Whether that was through user pressure or Apple working with Google, we're probably really never know. But, you know, Apple makes these decisions and sometimes they're wrong. And it, once it gets pointed out, I think they do come around. So I have hope for that, but I share your concerns in thinking that Apple might be getting too much power, too much control, and they could use that in really bad ways. But the other thing that keeps me hopeful is that blocking application choice in most cases doesn't benefit Apple. Blocking apps that directly copy functionality of other apps or could confuse users, I think ultimately benefits the end user, and maybe in some cases even developers. We've seen situations where a developer's application has been almost completely ripped off in terms of UI, and Apple has, with these rules, the power to block that sort of thing. But ultimately, Apple wants to sell more devices. They want to have a good number of apps, the most number of apps available of anybody else. They want to keep their developers happy, so I don't think they're going to just jump in there and start really hard and fast locking down on these rules. And if I think they do, the community will rise up and help protect their choice. They'll look out for their best interests. And historically, Apple will listen to that. We've seen them make mistakes before, but we've seen them come around. We saw it a lot early on with the iOS App Store, and I think we're going to see some of that with the Mac App Store. But in the long run, I think calmer heads will prevail, and we'll get the choices, and we won't have to be overly concerned about this stuff. And then finally, another OS X Lion innovation that I had mentioned I was really excited about was the upgrade to Mail.app and the addition of Mail Conversations. This is the concept where Apple's going to use some logic and some sort of smart technology to figure out what emails go together and kind of group them into these little conversations. It kind of takes threading, the concept of email threading, to the next level and brings in your replies. It strips out some of the quoted text and stuff like that if you want, and kind of puts everything into context. And I got a great tip from Paul, who said he has a way to kind of set up something like conversations in Snow Leopard, in Mail and Snow Leopard, and earlier versions of Mail, because it just uses and leverages the smart mailboxes. And if you don't know what smart mailboxes are, you should look into them. I've talked about them on the show before. Basically works like smart folders or smart albums, smart playlists. So we're getting used to this concept of being able to do kind of some filtering, set up some rules, and actually filter content. And I think some of this goes back into the earlier conversation I was having about Apple kind of rethinking how the Finder works. I think smart technology and filtering is going to be a big part of the new way that we do file management and organization and stuff like that. But you can leverage this in Mail.app to kind of get conversations. So I wanted to share this tip with you because I thought it was great. And what it enables you to do is get your emails and your replies together in a single threaded conversation. So you go into Mail, you create a new smart mailbox, and then when the rules list comes up at the top, you want to change the condition to any. I think by default it says all. So change it to any of the following conditions, and then you're going to add two conditions. The first one you're going to say where a message is in a mailbox, and then it'll ask you to select which mailbox and choose the inbox for the account that you want to set this up for. Then in the second condition, do the same thing. You're going to set the rule to where a message is in a mailbox, and then choose the corresponding sent mailbox that goes along with that inbox for that account. And then one more thing you need to do, check the little checkbox that says include messages from sent. And then give the smart mailbox a name. In my case, I did something like conversations from MacCast, from my MacCast account. So add that name, click OK, and then finally go access that smart mailbox from the list on the left in Mail, and then make sure in the view menu you have selected organized by thread. And when you do that, you'll get all of your outgoing mail and your replies or excuse me, you'll get all of the messages in your inbox along with the stuff that you've sent out, along with your replies, all kind of in one threaded conversation. And that worked out really great for me. I tried it out and it worked for the most part in my testing. I don't think it exactly mirrors, or I know it doesn't exactly mirror what Lion is going to be doing in terms of conversations, but I think it comes pretty close, and it was a great tip, and I want to thank Paul for sending that along, because it's been very helpful for me, at least until Lion comes out, because I'll probably be upgrading right away. But that's going to do it for today. A big show for you. It was a lot of fun. Before I leave you, I want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, if you want to get cash for your used electronics, your old iPods, iPads, what have you, and you don't want to deal with the hassles of auction listings or dealing with classified sites, check out Gazelle. You can go do a simple search. They'll give you a straight upfront offer for your device, and you can take advantage of that. You can get more information and details at gazelle.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook, check out their software as well as get free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make text expander, PDF pen, disk label, great applications I use and rely on each and every day. You can check out their stuff and get demos over at smilesoftware.com. Phoronix, they make Deep Freeze, PowerSave Mac, a bunch of other great applications. You can check them all out and get demos and more information at phoronix.com. And Stitcher Smart Radio, you can listen to live radio and stream podcasts through their Stitcher application. Also, you can sign up for a chance to win an iPad 2 simply by entering the code MACCAST when you sign up to become a new Stitcher member. Find out more information on their application and get details at stitcher.com/MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you. If you have any feedback for me, any questions, comments, you can send your emails to maccast@gmail.com or call in on our listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. Or if you'd like to leave voicemail on Skype, my Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. Be sure to check out the forum while you're there, forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. Alrighty then, that's going to do it. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.